I always enjoy getting a chance to talk to Lance Robert. He's the chief investment strategist for RIA Advisor. He's the lead editor of their Real Investment Report, which, by the way, has over 100,000 subscribers to it. He also hosts the Real Investment Show podcast. Lance, you're too busy for us, but I'm glad you're making time.
I always make time for you, Mike. So, I mean, that's never a problem.
Well, it is much appreciated. Yeah. Especially great week to have you. We had the Federal Reserve jump out this week. And I guess he wasn't as hawkish as people were worried about. I don't know. I can't believe I'm old enough to remember when Alan Greenspan sort of changed the game, where the central banker became the most dominant sort of investment related figure. And that continues to this day. I mean, everybody just hangs on the word of what our central bankers have to say. And that alone, you know, the level of manipulation available in the markets is huge. But what did you make of what Jerome Powell said? Because the market loved it.
No, they absolutely did. Just real quick, you're absolutely right. You know, when I was first starting in the money management game back in the 80s, you ask anybody on the street who the Federal Reserve chairman is, nobody knew. Nobody. And now everybody knows who the chairman is. And, you know, we no longer operate on fundamentals of stocks or anything else. It's all about what's the Fed going to do, because it's all about liquidity, right? And so at the FOMC meeting this week, one of the reasons that stocks took off running initially right after the meeting, markets turned around. They were down about 30 bips, went up over 1%. And the reason was because the Fed delivered a much more dovish message than what the market was expecting. And that was talking about the reversal of quantitative tightening. So quantitative tightening is where the Fed has been letting bonds mature on their balance sheet and not replacing them. And that's been removing liquidity slowly from the marketplace, from the economy, bank reserves, et cetera. And so by reducing that, they're now effectively saying, hey, we're going to provide more liquidity back to the market. So they went from $65 billion a month. Now, this doesn't include mortgage-backed securities. They didn't talk about that. That's another $30 billion. So we're talking about $95 billion a month, roughly. They're going to reduce the runoff of treasuries from $65 billion to $25 billion. That's a fairly big reversal. And so markets like that, obviously, that provides lots of liquidity. That's going to bring yields down, on the bond side as well. And I think the real message there is that yields are too high, and that's beginning to impact the economy. And we're seeing that, right? McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Starbucks, and all their latest reports really starting to show some consumer stress here. And that's both from high prices, i.e. inflation, but also higher interest rates, which are constricting the ability to borrow money. So I think the Fed's recognizing that liquidity impact, and they're starting to want to reduce that stress somewhat.
Yeah, I absolutely love that you're talking about liquidity, because that's the key. You know, if there's a lot of money in the system, hey, you can bid up prices. When there's not money, and we've been seeing that role. I mean, I've always pointed to September 16, 2019, the overnight repo market, you know, that fell apart. People are still kind of don't get the significance that rates were 2% annualized, and 4 hours later, they were 10%.
Right.
That should scare them. And we got a lot of other examples I could throw out today on that. But my point being, it was all about liquidity. So the Federal Reserve jumped in and said, oh, we're going to flush the system with money. And then the other example I'll give is, because I'm astounded when the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada and the politicians all said inflation was transitory.
Right.
And I'm going, are you kidding? In the U.S., they put 40% growth in the money supply, the amount of money flushed into the system. In Canada, it was 26% in 2 years, and we had supply shortages. So there's less stuff to buy. And they seriously stood there and go, I think it's transitory. And I'm saying my response, I think you're an idiot, but your point is so important to get. The system is looking at how much money's available to bid prices up. I know that's a simplification, but, that's really essentially what we're saying. So as you said, when the Federal Reserve sort of says, we were kind of taking a lot of money out of the system, we're going to keep an extra $40 billion in every month. Well, the market said, hallelujah, sister.
Well, it's actually a little bit bigger than that, Mike. And I think this is where, it kind of got lost in translation, so to speak. So what happens now is that, let's say that in the month of May, let's just pick a month, that they have $100 billion worth of treasuries maturing on their balance sheet.
Yeah.
So what they were doing is they'd say, okay, the $65 billion that matured, we're not going to replace, and we're going to buy another $35 billion to, you know, keep the, you know, keep our balances right. So what they're effectively saying, though, by reducing this to 25 is they are now going to be a net buyer of treasuries. So in other words, they have $100 billion maturing. They're going to buy $75 billion worth of bonds. And that's important because the Treasury Department, you know, Janet Yellen, i.e., yeah, they've been issuing a lot of debt here lately to, you know, meet this increased spending for the CHIPS Act, for the Inflation Reduction Act, which is all fueling into the economy. So now when the Treasury issues the bonds, all of a sudden there's now another buyer, and that's the Federal Reserve standing there saying, hey, I can buy, you want to issue $100 billion? That's fine. I can buy $75 billion of that issuance.
Are they doing that to keep interest rates down? Because, I mean, at some point, what if somebody looks and says, I want to be rewarded for the inflation that doesn't seem to be going away and the risk of just doing all of this over the last several years? I mean, we could pick a starting point, but we could be the year 2000, for goodness sakes, you know, on that approach. But my my question is, are they doing that? I mean, because we're seeing it in Japan right now. You do not want to see that 10-year bond go up because the cost to their whole system, you know, government system. So are they doing that like they did with the repo crisis? Let's keep rates down a little bit here.
Yeah, no, look, between now and wherever we get back to where we're going to be, you know, the Fed is going to wind up monetizing between 30% and 40% of debt issuance going forward. So, you know, as the government keeps issuing more and more debt to continue doing more and more spending, the Fed's going to have to monetize more and more of that debt because you have to monetize that debt to keep interest rates suppressed. Interest rates should have never been at 2-2.5% for the last decade, right? I mean, we had, you know, supposedly had good economic growth. We had very little inflation, and we kept interest rates on the Federal Reserve side, kept that at zero, and we kept the 10-year suppressed because we have so much debt in the system now, $34 trillion of government debt, 150% of debt to GDP, debt to households, right? Consumer debt to households, about 150%. So there's so much debt in the system. And this is what you're seeing with the consumer. When interest rates go up, they simply can't make ends meet because that debt servicing cost is extracting all their discretionary income. Mm-hmm. So they've got to bring rates back down in order to keep the economy from slipping into a recession. And that's the big worry they have, because if you get into a recession, that's very disinflationary. And that's a real problem for them to fight.
You know, and look at the poor investor sitting there saying, how am I supposed to navigate this? Because as you said right at the outset, you know, it's no longer particularly looking at the fundamentals of a company. You know, they're getting overshadowed by these kind of issues that we're talking about. And so what are you saying to your investors at this point?
Well, you know, it's funny because we're value investors. We've been long-term value investors, and we believe in fundamentals that matter. And, you know, eventually someday they're going to matter. And unfortunately, we have to manage the portfolio for growth because that's where we're at right now. And so, you know, we own the Apples and the Nvidias and the Amazons and those type of stocks because that's where earnings are coming from at the moment. But we also realize there's a big valuation premium being paid for that. You know, Apple's going to report earnings here today, actually, as you and I are talking. And that's going to be a big driver for the market because the market focuses now solely on this, you know, artificial intelligence. This is the new thing. And you and I remember the dot-com, you know, features back in 1990, 1991, 5, 9. And it was, you just stuck a dot-com name on something and prices went up. Yep. You know, the AI, you know, innovations are going to be fantastic. There'll be very few companies that actually win. And there's a ton of companies out there that are going to have failed business models. And so it's going to be very important to make sure you're picking the right companies. But, you know, this is the challenge for investors is that, you know, you have to measure making a return on your money when you have to, because again, we have to make our money grow because inflation is elevated right now. We're running at 3-3.5% inflation. So we need at least a 3-3.5% return this year just to offset the pace of inflation. So we've got to make money grow, even though the fundamentals and the valuation of the market certainly suggest that, you know, risk is to the downside. But again, this is where we go back to the Fed liquidity. You know, despite fundamentals being very elevated, there's so much money chasing the system and being supported by things like the Federal Reserve that we continue to develop these bigger gaps between prices and underlying valuations.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a difficult thing. You can say, You know, I love the chip business. We've been talking about it for 2 years now on Money Talks. About 2 years ago, right around now, by the way, I kind of realized that they were going to transfer, you know, all the chips getting made in Taiwan and the threat of China and all that. They're going to try and bring it back, at least to some degree, to Western influence. But it's the valuations that I can't wrap my head around. It's sort of, yeah, I love the story, but what value should I put on it? And, you know, 100% right. I mean, the market's loving it, so they're putting a huge valuation. And I guess I'm risk averse, so I just sort of worry, what if they, you know, it's not knocking the business, it's just saying what I paid for that business.
Well, look, and we have this conversation all the time with investors, and I do, you know, I do other interviews with people. And a lot of them are super bearish. It's like, you know, the dollar, you know, a couple of last year about this time, it was the death of the dollar. And now the dollar is screaming higher and the yen's falling. And, you know, all these narratives, you know, these very bearish narratives keep investors from investing capital. It's like, oh, I don't want to get caught into that, so I'm going to sit in cash. But the reality is that there's so much support for the financial markets. Nobody wants a major financial crash. You know, after the financial crisis that we had back in 2008, the Federal Reserve, the government, everybody else has said, we are not going to let that happen again. And that's why we saw during the pandemic, $5 trillion worth of cash being sent directly to households. That, and that's really, Mike, you know, going back to your point about inflation, that's why we have inflation. We sent checks to households. We gave people money to spend at a time where you had no supply available, right? Because you couldn't manufacture anything, everything was shut down. So that, you know, that was the perfect formula for this massive surge in inflation. But that's the new game book going forward. So whatever crisis we have coming up, wherever it happens and whenever it happens, whether it's a recession or a credit crisis, whatever it is, the immediate response is going to be Fed doing massive amounts of QE, dropping interest rates to zero, the government sending checks to households. That's not a good thing, by the way. It destroys the earning power and the wealth of the middle class to the poor class, concentrates more of the wealth in the upper 10% of the economy. But that's going to be the policy response from now on.
I absolutely couldn't agree more. I mean, you're describing the major theme on Money Talks is we just have to look around the world and see what the responses have been. And again, I gave an easy start date, which was that repo crisis in September 2019. Yeah. Look at the, I guess it was September 22, when they had the UK pension crisis. Mm-hmm. You had the Silicon Valley Bank in March of 23. You know, but your point being, and I think it's so important because it comes back to what do I have to do personally here? And as their response was, hey, they're going to flush that system. We're going to jump in there. We're not letting it happen. Well, of course, we've watched it destroy the purchasing power of the currency. And right. I think that's our lot in life. I keep saying that the number one challenge for individuals is to defend against that.
Right.
You know, and I, again, if I, let me just echo what you've said. I think really the pandemic made it clear we couldn't care less about poor people. Now, I would have made that point much earlier. You know, it's not, I wasn't Johnny come lately to that, but it was so obvious. Gee, let's look at all the policies. Who's going to benefit? Oh, I know, people with assets. And the people with a lot more assets are going to do more. And boy, you've left this huge chunk who were left with the inflation, but none of it was offset by gains in the assets.
That's
you know,
right.
They didn't own stocks. They didn't own housing or whatever, you know, what have you. People are still so naive to the fact that government fingerprints are all over every personal financial problem they have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a great point. You know, climate change is a really good example of exactly what you're talking about. And look, I'm not talking for or against climate change. So,
yeah,
you know, but I'm not saying that, but it's a really great example. So the government says we need to fix the climate. Okay, so we have a couple of choices, right? We could go plant a bunch of trees and that would help solve your climate crisis because they absorb 48 pounds of carbon, right? So we know that. But what we said was, no, everybody's got to drive an electric vehicle. Well, who makes electric vehicles? Elon Musk, right? So now all of a sudden we push all these policies. We give subsidies because it's our job to fight climate change that we need to go buy a product from somebody who's going to help us solve this, whether it's solar panels or whether it's, you know, double pane windows or whether it's an electric vehicle or a battery or whatever it is. somebody's making that product. Well, who has most of the wealth in the country? Those are the business owners. So the business owners lobby government and say, you know what would be really great is if we're going to fight climate change, you should provide a subsidy so people can buy my cars. And we made Elon Musk the richest man on the planet. Right. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but that's what we're talking about here is that's how you transfer the wealth from the middle class to the wealthy. That's how that transfer happens. It's a mechanism set in place that when you go to buy those products to fight whatever policy that the government wants you to challenge, who you have to ask yourself the question, who's going to benefit from this? It's also an investment thesis as well. So when government passes a policy, you say, who's going to benefit from this? The CHIPS Act, right? That's the chip companies. You go buy chip stocks, right? So from an investment standpoint, it's important to understand when these policies are implemented, ask yourself who's going to benefit. And really, is it for the benefit of the middle class or is it for the benefit of the sponsors of the policy in Washington?
Well, and think about just something straightforward like electric car subsidies. Well, gee, I can tell you, not many low-income people are lining up to buy those electric cars. Right. But yet their taxes go to afford those subsidies. Like, it's outrageous. And again, you joining us today from Texas, you wouldn't be as aware of this as Canadians are. But you should see what they've been doing at the federal level here. They've literally committed about it's about $41 billion to build EV plants. But right. Who's getting it? Stellantis, Ford, Volkswagen, Honda, huge taxpayer subsidies. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on whether that's going to be good or not. I will. It won't be. They are not going to work out. They are not going to meet those targets. There's so many things to it. But it doesn't matter. Who benefited is my point. You know, just one more. They've given subsidies just for electric battery manufacturing several times larger than the entire Canadian auto industry. Like we're just in la la land with this stuff.
Yeah. And again, you know, just real quick, I don't want anybody to leave this, you know, discussion day being upset. I'm all for, you know, making sure we, you know, pass our planet on healthy to our future generations. So I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying we need to understand that when we pass policies, there is a cost to that. It's not a free lunch. And unfortunately, if we take a look at it here in America in particular, the top 10% of income earners own 90% of the market, right? So it really, for 80% of the population, whether the market's up or down in a month or 2 months or a year has no bearing on their outcome. They have about $500 in the bank and they're just trying to make ends meet. So all these policies erode their purchasing power and erode their standard of living. And we keep separating out the wealthy from everybody else. And we're crushing that middle class. We're shrinking that middle class, which is so dynamically important to grow an economy over time. And this is why economic growth is going to slide to below 2% in the U.S. over the next decade. We're going to be looking at sub 2% growth as the demographic ages. We're not producing enough live births in this country to offset the aging population. That's going to drag inflation lower. That's going to drag interest rates lower. And lower interest rates, believe it or not, are not a good thing, right? You say, well, low interest rates are great because I can borrow money cheap and I can go buy stuff. But low interest rates in an economy destroys economic wealth because of the return on that capital that's loaned by banks or by individuals that are having to loan money at a much lower rate, rather than creating a rate that's actually sufficient for future growth in the economy.
Well, let's finish with sort of broad brushing. You obviously don't know everyone listening today. Even I don't. Right. You know, and so we don't know your circumstances. That's why I always say, you know, check with a professional. I mean, this is what you're doing. You provide the blueprint for RIA investment advisors and RIA advisors. And yeah, okay, so let's work within this a bit that they could then have some questions, go talk to their professional to see if it fits with them. Right. But again, what sort of broad strokes would you present to deal with, not as a trader, but as an investor, as someone looking to protect myself, to not come out in the short end of the stick over the next 4 or 5 years, whatever time frame you prefer?
Well, the problem is there's so many dynamics to that question because just real quick, I mean, you know, what's your time horizon to actually needing your capital? Are you young? Are you old? You know, how much capital you have to invest? Yeah. But just broad strokes, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think you have to have a portfolio that's focused on dividend yielding equities. The reason that dividend yielding equities tend, they won't beat the market from one year to the next, right? So in a market where Amazon and Apple are driving the S&P, dividend yielding stocks are going to underperform. But dividend paying companies tend to be better stewards of capital over time because they have to pay that dividend. Mm-hmm. So if you look for companies that have been paying a regular dividend and growing that dividend on a regular basis, or what, dividend grower stocks, those tend to be more stable and will grow your capital over time. And plus you're receiving the income from that stock while it's growing as well. Again, you're not going to beat the S&P. So if that's your goal, that's not going to work for you. But it's a good way to kind of stabilize a portfolio. And look, inflation is going to come down. The reason it's going to come down is really twofold. But primarily, you're crushing the middle class, right? They are simply going to have to spend less at some point. They can't keep borrowing at the rate that they're borrowing to spend money. And that's what drives inflation. It's basic economics, supply versus demand. If you lower the demand, supply is going to reduce and inflationary prices are going to come down. So that's going to happen. It's a function of time until you get there. But that is going to be a drag there. So start thinking about locking in some higher income right now. I'm a big buyer right now of 20-year treasuries because I can lock in 4.5% right now for the next 20 years. And in an environment that particularly is going to probably grow at somewhere around 3%-ish over the next decade, having a 4% rate of return certainly helps me offset that current rate of inflation at 3.5%. So, I think those two in particular, I think you've got to really kind of focus on as a kind of a base for your portfolio. Then if you want to step out and start looking at real estate or other assets on top of that, then that's perfectly fine. But I think you build the base of things that provide liquidity and return. And I think that gives you a good baseline to kind of launch off from for whatever investments you want to add to that.
Let me just finish with a quick word, and I know it's 25 words or less, but the gold should portfolios have this sort of gold section, as a hedge against the declining purchasing power and other things that may well happen.
Right. Yeah, and that, again, whatever else you want to add to your portfolio mix, right? If you want to add some gold, commodities, mm-hmm. Commodities are inflation sensitive. So if you have if you think inflation is going to continue to rage, then commodities should do well. Real estate is always going to do well. If you own actual real estate, they can't make more land, right? You've heard that old axiom. So real estate is always going to be a good investment in the portfolio. Prices are going to go up and down, obviously, but real estate never goes to zero. And it was interesting. I just went to a distressed credit conference just this past week in Milwaukee, and investment bankers and people that are all dealing with distressed debt, they are lining up right now to buy distressed commercial real estate, and they cannot buy it fast enough because the discounts are so deep on this. There are buildings that are trading at 25 and 30 cents on the dollar. So once we get through this commercial real estate kind of issue, then there's going to be some real returns made on that distressed credit side as well. So, again, there's so many more opportunities again, but, build that base. And then from there, you can add to that whatever theme that it is that you think you need to add to it for whatever you think your outcomes are going to be.
Well, look, the great news is you can go to RIA Advisor. So all you have to do, the newsletter is realinvestmentadvice.com. realinvestmentadvice.com. Get more thoughts. Lance, as I say, I sincerely thank you for taking the time. I know you've got a busy schedule. Look at the markets, look at the job you've got, but we really appreciate it. Thanks for the insight.
My pleasure. Always happy to be here, Mike.